Channel liquidity and offline receives, in my opinion, are the two most obvious reasons why self-custodial Lightning is not popular. When most users hear about any of these, they just think, screw that, and move to a custodial wallet, because it is so much easier. If these were our only two problems, I think self-custodial Lightning would be fine. It may never be the predominant way people use Lightning, but we could get the UX good enough that we have a significant portion of people using Lightning in a sovereign way. However, there are more problems under the surface. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And this show is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin and CoinKite. If you want to buy Bitcoin and you want to plug Bitcoin into your financial life, go to Swan. And if you want to withdraw that Bitcoin to your own keys and be a sovereign Bitcoiner, get yourself a cold card. And yes, it really is that simple. Links to our sponsors will be in the show notes. So we've got a really good article today that a bunch of people are calling this FUD. People really don't like it when their favorite things are criticized. And as much as I am absolutely in love with Lightning, this is true. These are the complications that Lightning is happening. And I've been thinking and talking for a long time about the fact that we need to think differently about what Lightning is, where it lies in the stack. And I think this is the same transition that we had to undergo with Bitcoin initially and realizing where Bitcoin's limitations are. And that's when we moved and rethought the path of engineering and scaling towards the Lightning direction, the idea of layers. And now we're going to have to rethink Lightning and the layer that we have built out. And as we hit its limitations and understand where it has significant trade-offs or characteristics that make it explicitly great for one certain set of environment or certain set of applications, and then not very good for a different set and in a different environment. Now that we know more about it and we see it in action and we use it, it's time to rethink Lightning. And that's what this article is about, by Ben the Carman. You know him, longtime Bitcoiner, and now they are over there at Mutiny Wallet building some amazing stuff. You should definitely be following him. I will have the link to his Noster and Twitter accounts and the link to this article if you would like to zap it and give a little value for value back. With that, let's jump right into today's read. And it's titled, Rethinking Lightning by Ben the Carman. Over the last few months, it feels like the Bitcoin community has gotten more and more jaded on Lightning. To be honest, this is for good reason. Back in 2017, we were promised a decentralized payment network that would always have cheap payments and everyone would be able to run their own node. Nowadays, the average Lightning user actually isn't using Lightning. They're just using a custodial wallet, and the few of those that do run Lightning nodes often find it a burdensome task. For us at Mutiny Wallet, we are trying to make this better by creating a lightweight self-custodial wallet, and in my opinion, we have been executing on that dream fairly well. In this post, I'll analyze these issues and present a new way to view Lightning and what that means for Bitcoin going forward. First and foremost, one of the hardest UX challenges of Lightning is channel liquidity. No other payment system has these problems today besides Lightning. So this often confuses lots of users. To make matters worse, there aren't any practical hacks that we can do to get around this. Moon Wallet used an on-chain wallet plus submarine swaps to get around the channel liquidity problem. This works very well until fees went up and everyone realized it wasn't actually a Lightning wallet. The better solution is JIT liquidity, or just-in-time liquidity, like we do in Mutiny, or splicing like that is done in Phoenix. These solutions abstract some of it away, but not enough. We often get support questions confused on why some payments have fees and others do not. The fact is, channel liquidity is not a usable user experience for most end users. The other major pain point of Lightning is the offline receive problem. Inherently, you must be online with your private keys to sign and claim a payment. There is technically an ongoing spec proposal to be able to work around this, essentially creating a notification system of when people are online to receive payments, but it doesn't solve the fundamental problem and still has limitations. There has been a few attempts to get around this, most notably was Zeus Pay Lightning addresses. These essentially worked by just creating stuck payments and waited for the user to come online to claim. This caused a ton of problems for people and even forced us at Mutiny to block users from paying them because it caused so many forced closures. This is a hard problem because the entire rest of the Bitcoin and crypto ecosystem works by just copy-paste an address and you can send to it whenever. There isn't caveats around asking your friend to open their wallet. This is further exacerbated by things like Lightning Address that requires a web server to even get an invoice in the first place. Channel liquidity and offline receives, in my opinion, are the two most obvious reasons why self-custodial Lightning is not popular. When most users hear about any of these, they just think, screw that, and move to a custodial wallet because it is so much easier. If these were our only two problems, I think self-custodial Lightning would be fine. It may never be the predominant way people use Lightning, but we could get the UX good enough that we have a significant portion of people using Lightning in a sovereign way. However, there are more problems under the surface. Channel liquidity is a problem, but it is also deceptive. When you have 100,000 sats of inbound liquidity, you would think you could receive up to 100,000 sats, but this isn't the case. Often, you can't actually receive any. This is because of on-chain fees. When a payment is being made in Lightning, you are creating pre-signed transactions that have outputs for every in-flight payment. These outputs cost potential on-chain fees, and the higher these on-chain fees go, the more it eats into your liquidity. After we solved most of our forced close issues at Mutiny, this has been the number one support request. Even if you do everything right, understanding liquidity and having enough for your payment, sometimes it still won't work because on-chain fees are too high. This is always really discouraging because isn't the whole point of Lightning to not have to pay on-chain fees? Fundamentally, all current Lightning channels could become entirely useless if on-chain fees went high enough because a single payment would require too many reserves. Obviously, this is hyperbolic, but I hope I'm getting the point across that on-chain fees don't just affect the opening and closing costs of channels. Even if you are a diligent node runner that only opens channels when fees are low, that is not enough. Your channels need to be large enough to pay for the on-chain fees of each HTLC at any future on-chain fee rate. As on-chain fees go up and up, this problem will only get worse. The proposed solution to these reserve issues are things like anchor channels, package relay, ephemeral anchors, etc. These are all well and good, but kind of just mask the problem. They do solve it so the fee reserve can be much lower and possibly zero, however, with the trade-off that you need on-chain funds available to fee bump your forced closes so they can actually get into a block. This again breaks the UX for self-custodial users because they have to hold on-chain funds alongside their Lightning funds so they can do those on-chain fee bumps. The size requirements for their on-chain funds is still dynamically based on how high on-chain fees can spike. Solutions for this can include having someone else bump your transaction fees, but this brings basically a trusted third party into the mix and isn't ideal. When you lay out all the different trade-offs a Lightning node needs to make, especially in a high-fee environment, it makes me think, what are we doing here? Are we going down the wrong path? Lightning is still fundamentally a fantastic payment protocol, but its limitation is that it requires scale. Basically, every problem I've outlined goes away when you have a large Lightning node with lots of liquidity and high uptime, so maybe we should optimize for that. The market has been telling us this for years already. 90%+ of Lightning users are using custodial wallets because it works so much better at scale. So how can we use large-scale Lightning nodes without custodial wallets? Combining existing large-scale Lightning infrastructure with self-custodial solutions, sadly, isn't totally possible. The only real way to do that as of now is Moon Wallet, which, as we talked about earlier, doesn't really solve the problem because everything is just an on-chain transaction. However, Moon was onto something. The architecture of having a simpler protocol interface with Lightning is genius and gives us the best of both worlds. We can make fast, cheap payments and let the big boys collect fees for running the Lightning node. Aqua Wallet launched what is essentially a Moon Wallet but built on top of Liquid. This is a good band-aid fix, but doesn't get to the root of the problem. Before we go further, we should take a step back and break down what problems we are trying to solve. Bitcoin has a fundamental scaling limitation through the block size. If we could make it infinite, then we wouldn't necessarily need any layer 2s because we could just make on-chain payments. However, we live in the real world and have a 1 megabyte block size limit, and this limits the number of transactions we can make on-chain. Lightning is a huge improvement to Bitcoin because we don't need to put every transaction on-chain. We just need to open a channel and can make seemingly countless payments. So why isn't Lightning the silver bullet? Lightning lets us move payments off-chain, but what it doesn't do is let us move ownership off-chain. Fundamentally, Lightning still relies on that, at the end of the day, a UTXO goes to a single user. So even if every on-chain transaction was a Lightning channel, we still run into the limit of how many people can actually own those channels. What we need is another layer 2 that can scale UTXO ownership and can interop with Lightning. That way, we have a way to scale ownership combined with scaling payments. So how do we scale ownership? Simply put, the answer today is custody. Whether that is pure custodial like a wallet of Satoshi, or in the gray area like Fediments and Liquid, the only way to do it today is through custody or federated bridges. In Bitcoin, the only way to delegate ownership of a UTXO to multiple parties is through multisig. However, that requires every user to be online when anyone wants to transact. And when you go down this path far enough, you just end up reinventing Lightning. Are we doomed, then? Is there no way to scale Bitcoin in a self-sovereign way? Luckily, the answer is no. But we need some soft forks. Covenants are the way to scale Bitcoin ownership. There are a bunch of covenant proposals, but at their core, what they propose to do is to add a way so that you can have a Bitcoin address that limits where and how the coins in it can be spent. This can seem scary, but we already have these in Bitcoin today. OpsCTLV, Check Lock Time Verify, which was soft forked in 2016, only allows you to spend from a Bitcoin address if the transaction has a given lock time. This lets you gate when a UTXO can be spent. What the current covenant proposals do is let you gate where a UTXO can be spent. With that simple primitive, many different protocols can be built that allow for scaling ownership. There are a lot of current covenant proposals, the main ones being OpsCTV, OpsVault, OpsCSFS, OpsTXHash, OpsCat, and APO. They all have different functionality and trade-offs. But in my opinion, we should be looking towards activating a form of covenants because otherwise, we will likely be moving towards a future of less sovereign Bitcoin users. The future is not bleak, however. Even without covenants, we can still scale Bitcoin for the world, just not in the ideal way. At Mutiny, we are full steam ahead on implementing Fediment into the wallet. In my opinion, and the rest of the team's, it looks like the best current scaling solution for Bitcoin. Fediments give us the ability to dynamically share ownership over a group of UTXOs and is able to interop with Lightning through gateways. It is the pinnacle of the scaling dream for Bitcoin with current technology, and I can't wait to help make it a reality while we can. This episode is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin. I was actually reading a post recently of someone asking for, a friend of theirs was trying to get their retirement allocated to Bitcoin, and they were trying to figure out how to set up an IRA. And a number of people in the thread, including myself, mentioned the Swan IRA. This can be set up in 5 to 10 minutes. It takes very little time, and it can be done both as a traditional or Roth variety, and you can immediately start allocating Bitcoin to it. As far as moving your other IRA that you already have, different setups have different restrictions on how or just difficulty and how to move it. So it could be something that you can do very easily, or it might be a process that takes a little bit of time. But I urge you to look into it if you still have a fiat-denominated retirement account, because I think this is a critical time and a very opportunistic time to make that transition if you have not done it yet. You can check it all out at swan.com/guy. The link will be right there in the show notes. And don't forget, obviously, Swan is also a great place to buy Bitcoin, to auto stack, to get your business allocated, add it to employee benefit plans, all sorts of stuff. They are a great solution for a ton of your Bitcoin financial needs. Again, check them out at swan.com/guy. All right. Shout out to Ben for this article. I guess it's an article. He posted it on Abla.news on Noster, and then also on Stacker News, both of which are great places to hang out with Bitcoiners and play around with Lightning. They are both highly Lightning integrated, and Stacker News is one that I don't give enough shout out to, because they have built something really cool, and they have consistently delivered, and they've been around for a while now, and it's a really cool platform. It's basically what Reddit should have been. So I'm going to remember to shill that a little bit more often if I can. And on that, actually, Fedimint has just released version 0.2, and they have opened up a little thread and provided some links and conversation for all the Fedimint stuff. It's a new Fedimint territory. So that's something to check out if you haven't. I will have the link to it in the show notes. Oh, on that, actually, good to remind you that you can zap this on Noster and on Abla.news, which is Noster as well, or you can zap it on Stacker News. So if you want to, you know, do some value for value and you want to give them, donate some sats to somebody who has created some great content, go over there and give Ben the Carmen a couple of zaps for this one, because I think this was a really great article. And he does a good job of specifically of just kind of laying out where the problems are. And this is why I've talked about, I think the mental framing has been needing a massive shift for quite some time. And I talked a bit about this during the difficult adjustment episode, the article we read by Mark Goodwin and, oh, I forgot the other author. I apologize. But it's funny because this narrative has been around, or narrative, this realization, this acceptance has been around since the very beginning. Like, literally some of these details are in the Lightning Network white paper, in the initial conversations around the Lightning Network, that there was a scaling limit. Like it hit a wall as well. This was never an end solution. This was always a step to the next layer, so to speak. And this is why I've always thought that we needed a layer 3 solution, that somewhere along the way, we're going to find a way to, as he said, I thought Ben put it really, really well in narrowing out the difference, or distinguishing the difference between what we need for a new layer and how it will work best with Lightning, and where Lightning is amazing. Is that Lightning is a payments scaling technology, while what we still need is an ownership scaling technology. We need a layer for ownership expansion and a layer for payments expansion. I thought that was a really, really great distinction of laying out that those are the two pieces that we need, and Lightning does one of them great. And this is why it's going to be, I'm inclined to think it's going to be thought of more as this inter-business and inter-service provider global payment network that just has no borders. Like, it's going to be infrastructure. We are treating it like an end-user product, and while some of the interactions with it will be at the end-user, I think it will largely be a way to interconnect all of the smaller sort of side-chain, channel pool, liquidity pool sort of smaller, like fraternity family style networks. And there was recently, man, I've forgotten what these were named. What was the titles of these? We read a 3-series response between a handful of people, kind of explaining how you can actually scale Bitcoin to, you know, 8 billion people and what that actually looks like. And that's really kind of the first, I think, lengthy period of like 4 episodes that we actually ever covered, where I think we really hit the idea really hard. But I loved this distinction that Ben added to the table of granularizing the separation and or the extension of ownership, as well as the extension of payments from the base layer. And one thing that he points out that is phenomenal. And I think why it's going to be best thought of as infrastructure, I think is a strong indication of this, is the fact that Lightning Network works phenomenally at scale. Past the bootstrapping phase, if you actually grow it a little bit and you have a substantial Lightning node, Lightning works phenomenally well, but you need excess capital and you need a strong position in order for it to do that. Otherwise, you need a bridge. You need someone who's going to provide that sort of functionality. And that's why what Mutiny is doing, what Phoenix, what Breeze really pioneered, what Slash Tags, or not Slash Tags, but BitKit Wallet, and what's their, oh my God, I can't remember the freaking name of their liquidity pool or their Lightning service provider. Wait, I think theirs is called Block Tank. I think that's right. And there's the Dunder LSP with the Blixt wallet. There's a bunch of these now. This has become kind of the common course. And I think that makes sense because the Lightning node itself and having lots of channels is specifically it's kind of like a network connection. It's like running a router on the internet. You're running a router for payments, for payment communications, for liquidity in that payment network, which means you need to be active if you're actually moving things through the network. It is literally infrastructure. So the end user, especially the mobile device, makes way more sense at the end, at the edge of the network, so that they're not being moved through to make payments because you have incredibly unreliable connectivity and bandwidth. Bandwidth being liquidity, Bitcoin reserves locked into these channels. So the trick to give them a excellent user experience, which these wallets have done, is they automatically open channels whenever new bandwidth is needed. They essentially manage the channels from their side and then push all of the relevant payments. But as he explains, the problem with that user experience is the fact that you get fees in a completely erratic way. You don't know when you're going to need new liquidity, and the fee structure doesn't make sense. And the way they use it can have enormous differences in what that fee structure is. Like if you have 100,000 sats in a 100,000 sat channel with whatever your LSP is, and then you're not spending it, you don't give yourself any bandwidth, and then you just receive a bunch of 1,000 sat, you're trying to just receive a bunch of very small payments to that wallet because you think, oh, I'm just going to, this is my small payment wallet. I can just send a bunch of tiny payments back and forth. But every single time you're just adding to it and you end up paying like 3,000 sats in fees or paying the whole amount in fees because you need new liquidity. You need to change the bandwidth available to receive on the other side of that. Well, you're in the worst case scenario when it comes from having to make changes on chain because you're not giving yourself any gap. But I mean, that might be exactly how a lot of people try to use it. So you have all these workarounds from like the market side of things. Okay, well, the LSP is going to automatically add 50,000 sats, but this makes the burden on holding enormous amounts of reserves and offering massive amounts of liquidity, it makes it's a service, it's a business essentially. And at the end of the day, the reason all of these individual people own it, even though they have a multi-sig with the LSP, is because they can take it back to the chain that it's their UTXO, that it goes straight to an account, to an address or a set of keys on the Bitcoin network that are entirely owned by them. And at the end of the day, Bitcoin does not scale for all 8 billion people to have their own UTXO. So Lightning has scaled payments massively. My own case is a great example. I'm essentially a power user. I don't really do much with my node other than just try to have a good position, and it's mostly liquidity for my purposes. And for letting other people that I talk to and, you know, Audionauts and things that I work with connect and hopefully have a pretty decent position into the Lightning Network. But just in my example, I know I'm doing 50 times as many, maybe 100 times. I don't know. I use it a lot now because I'll just browse Noster and just zap, 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 zap like crazy out of my Phoenix wallet. In fact, almost everything that I do now, like the vast majority, like 98% of what I do is on Lightning. And when I have to go back to on-chain Bitcoin directly, it's merely because of very large payments. So going back to Ben's distinction or mental framework is what we have solved is the scaling of payments. The boast of, you know, a million transactions per second is actually not unrealistic when this lightning, when the Lightning Network grows to an enormous size. It can scale and perform that. The problem is it can't do it for a billion nodes. And that many different Lightning channels can't possibly be enforced in a way, in a short time frame, in a way that actually allows everyone to end up enforcing their ownership. Now, the mental model that I like to apply to this, or why I don't think it's necessary, I think we are inevitably going to have the network grow, where layer twos and layer threes are large enough that, I mean, I guess it's necessary. It's necessarily the case. Like, we know that this is going to be the case, where everyone can't close it all down to validate and have absolute max sovereignty and confirmation of their ownership at the same time. Like, that's just not possible. But that's generally not necessary anyway. When you need that is when it is in contest, is when there is massive conflict and you need to prove it against all adversaries. That situation would literally suggest that there is no trust between any two people anywhere on the planet. Like, this would be a total, for total and absolute complete sovereignty for every individual to be necessary, would be a complete and total breakdown of the very notion of trust between humans and social communities. So the real reason why custodians will always exist is because trust isn't going anywhere. People still trust each other, and they will trust each other, and that's a great thing because that's what society is built on. So there will be custodians, there will be groups. The point of that total sovereignty is that when the trust breaks down, do you then have a way to be sovereign at the moment that you need it? So I liken this to needing a court. How often in your day-to-day activity do you have to sue somebody? Do you have to go to court to solve a dispute? It's not very often. You can go to, there's a lot of different steps where 99.9% of problems are solved before things are forced into a courtroom. I think that's largely how Bitcoin on-chain is going to be seen in the future, is that it's the ownership of last resort. Trust in my local companies broke down. Trust in my city and state government has broken down. Trust in my nation state and even my very local community has all broken down. I need to get the hell out of here, and I need to have full and complete absolute sovereignty ownership over all of my capital. I need to go on-chain right now with everything. I think the ticket to basically having that capacity for the whole world when they need it is to try everything we can to make sure that Bitcoin can do this for 10% of the world population. Because I think it's relatively safe to assume that 90% of the world at most times will stay together as opposed to be destroyed. But that would still mean that we need an exit plan from all of these systems. It would still be far, far better for that fediment to have some sort of enforceable contract, like an ARC setup, maybe is the better example, where it's like a Lightning Network connection or pool, and everybody has that quote-unquote exit clause where they own it. And unless we have new primitives, essentially trying to get to that point, I think, just starts making things far, far more complex. Like, Lightning is a very complex system. It's funny, a lot of its restrictions are specifically because of its security elements. Like, the liquidity is a problem, and the reason, like, he specifically says in this that Ben's like, well, we don't have any liquidity problems for any other payment networks. And he's exactly right, but that's because the liquidity problem doesn't, you don't need reserves. The problem with liquidity on Lightning is the fact that you have to have actual capital in the channel with ownership of both parties in order to make a valid transaction with it. So understand, what we have is a solution to fractional reserve in a global decentralized payment network. We cannot discount what has been achieved, while simultaneously we still have a long, long way to go to get to the ideal, to get to what we are trying to do, to get to the promise that Bitcoin offers. But even that sort of construction, where you're in an arc or a channel pool or something where you could enforce your ownership if you needed to, what it still ends up meaning, and he has a really great quote from this, Ben does, from the article, says that fundamentally, Lightning still relies on that at the end of the day, a UTXO goes to a single user. And that is also the case when we're talking about ARC or any of these channel pools or anything like that. In fact, it's actually the case even with CTV, with a very interesting caveat or covenants. CTV is just one of the flavors of covenants. So as Ben pointed out, this is a really critical way to separate the ownership, or excuse me, not to separate, to divide up the ownership of a UTXO. What Lightning did is it turned one transaction into 50, 100, thousands of payments, but you still need the one transaction, and you are still limited by the bandwidth in that one transaction. What we need is one UTXO to go to ownership of many people. We need the LAN networks of our WAN networks. We have that when it comes to payments. Now we need it when it comes to ownership. And when you start multiplying those things together, you get a very, very interesting dynamic as to what you can accomplish on the Bitcoin network as far as expanding this out. And in fact, I'll link to the episode we talked about timeout trees, which are a CTV-based construction of, just because everybody's been talking about like, oh, we would be able to build all these protocols, but nobody actually, I don't think there are any other actual concrete proposals of what those protocols might look like. And this is actually a really simple one that was drawn up that is basically you have a CTV output where everybody owns some subset of the funds of one, you know, UTXO. You have one address that's got like 100 Bitcoin in it, and there's actually 100 people inside of it who all own one Bitcoin, and every single one of them can take the, at any point, they can spend this UTXO and get their one Bitcoin. But they don't want to. They don't want to. They want to split the ownership of this UTXO and not have to spend on-chain transaction. But there's like a one-month time lock on this where after a month, the operator, the service provider of the CTV, of this pool of users, can actually sweep all the funds themselves. And what they do is they write new transactions with each of the individual users with a new CTV output and a new balance. And every month they are able to refresh it and broadcast it to this new set of addresses and balances. And that's it. Really simple construction. And what it does is it gives you a means of making a lot of internal payments. In fact, you can actually have all of these one Bitcoin addresses that you open with all of these users. You can actually, they're again entirely off chain. It's just that this one address cannot be sent anywhere. Again, actually, I don't think I've fully clarified that. It's all of these covenant proposals, as Ben specifically says, is what the current covenant proposals do is let you gate where a UTXO can be spent. With that simple primitive, many different protocols can be built that allow for scaling ownership. What this means essentially is, you know, in order to move a Bitcoin, you have to sign it with the key necessary to unlock the transaction, unlock those coins. And essentially what something like CTV does and all of the other covenant proposals do is some form of being able to put in explicit information about the next transaction in the signature that you give to lock the address. So it's as if you use your private key to sign this transaction, but it also included as part of your private key, this is the transaction and this is the amount. This is the only thing that can be signed in order for it to be valid. So you're able to actually put the transaction details in your signature or in the lock that is used to create the location for the Bitcoin, so that the only way for them to unlock it was to both have that signature, but then also to send it directly to that location that you specified in the amount that you specified. So because of that, you essentially own it even before it gets sent to you, because they can't do anything except send it to you. This allows you to basically have a sovereign relationship with someone who is a service provider, where you could have an ongoing relationship where you're constantly updating things, but you still have in your back pocket the ability to go to court at any time and challenge what this service provider is doing to you. I mean, imagine if you could spend 50, whatever your situation or relationship is with the bank, that if they ever tried to screw you, if they ever tried to charge you too much of a fee, or they ever tried to lock you out of your account, you could spend $50 instantly and get it all back. Or you could move it to a completely different service provider in a completely different jurisdiction in one go. Maybe it costs $100. But imagine if you could do that. There was no bank that could prevent you from doing that. Now imagine if all of those, going back to the example, is that all of those one Bitcoin addresses, all of those CTV addresses that said you have to send it to me. Well, it's actually you have to send it to me in an address that is in that is a Lightning channel. Well, then you can basically treat that channel as if it is opened already, and you can have a presence on the Lightning network without even having the UTXO that your reserves are in. Because at the end of the day, only that address can ever be sent to chain, and then you have the punishment and enforcement clause of that address to then take that to chain. And you can just cram it all into one transaction and broadcast it. So you open and execute the punishment clause, the justice clause of the Lightning channel in basically one go. So in trying to imagine what a future, if you could have a construction that is just kind of that naive in a sense, where you're doing this, where you could essentially open up, you know, millions, billions of Lightning channels in extremely short amount of time, and you could do it short amounts of time, because you could do it with basically, you know, 100, 1,000. I mean, technically you could do it behind one UTXO, really. So a way to imagine it, if we were just trying to compare it to the fiat world and how we think of relationships and service providers and banks and finances and payments and all that sort of stuff. Imagine if you were doing everything in a basically custodial manner most of the time, or at least it felt like that, and you got all of the benefits of the custodial. I mean, you think about it, I go to my bank account now, and when I receive a payment or send a payment even, I'll just see it sitting there for a long time and it just says pending. You know, it's like 2 days sometimes. Well, what if that was actually common in the Bitcoin space as far as service providers that you got? And what that actually meant is that you had updated your CTV transaction with your financial provider and they're batching it with, you know, millions of other customers, or they just do it every day. Let's say they just do it every day at 5 o'clock. Let's go super traditional thinking. Every day at 5 o'clock, they update their batch CTV for everybody's channels. And in the meantime, they have a pool of their own resources inside that CTV, which they use to receive when they don't have enough capacity or bandwidth with any of the individual users. So they receive payments on your behalf, and that's managed directly in the wallet. It shows up as a pending transaction, and then the next day it's confirmed in your account. And that's because they rebroadcasted the batch UTXO that has all of their clients' funds in it, and basically updated the reserves in every single person's account. Now, this would allow you to, you know, have a 0.1% fee or 0.5% fee or whatever for all of your payments, specifically because they were batching it and you're splitting it up between a massive amount of payments and a massive amount of clients. So you get insanely low fees. However, picture that there's also a force button. Every time you end up in this situation and, you know, something's not going through, or now you're confused and you call support and they're not helping you, there's a force button that just says, just force it to happen. And it costs a transaction fee. It costs $50. And that would happen if your bank froze your account. That would happen if the government tried to freeze it. Literally anyone. And you hit that force button and you execute on chain. Now, this level of service integration would probably come with lots and lots of trade-offs. But the really powerful thing about this is the permissionless nature. Ben is like building this stuff. Like the reason banks are such powerful gatekeepers is because you can't even get access to the networks. You have no access to payment networks. You have no access to banking communications. Like, it's an entirely closed system. There is nobody that they can stop from building any service-related or a protocol or software related solution for these things. It is as open and available to any solution that we can build as the internet was to the idea of creating Bitcoin. Is that you couldn't have your access to the internet limited to prevent the creation of Bitcoin from coming into existence. So during this transition where we're trying to figure out, and we may have an endless set of problems, it may just never be complete. I mean, it kind of makes sense just because the ideal is almost an impossibility anyway. And if you think about it, people like to think that we were far more secure, that everybody, when everybody was using their own keys and had their own sovereign ownership in Bitcoin back when the network was small enough in the 2013, maybe 2014 era, that, oh, those were the good old days of like peak sovereignty and everybody was on chain and everybody held their own keys. Yeah, I'm inclined to think, the more I think about it, that no, that's not the case, because the entirety of Bitcoin itself was weak. Like, a large supercomputer could have screwed it up. The government could have shut it down. If they had aggressively attacked the entire thing, maybe individually among Bitcoiners, there was greater sovereignty. But there wasn't greater sovereignty against the government. I think that specifically requires the scale of the economic value in order to build that force field of proof of work. That even those in small circles and in semi-trusted or trusted relationships in smaller communities may actually be on a large timeline or in kind of the big picture better protected from governments, and that trust has moved towards the local communities or the people you interact with directly. So there may just be trade-offs everywhere forever. I mean, that's kind of the nature of things, right? And you can almost just call that axiomatic, is, you know, like Thomas Sowell says, is there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. And, you know, this was always the thing with the block size war, is that it wasn't about, well, we could have everything we ever wanted and everybody could be on chain and everybody could have total sovereignty if we just made the block size infinite. It's like, no, you fail to realize that that's how you get nothing. That's how you get absolutely nothing. You get none of the decentralization, none of the security, none of the verifiability, none of the auditability. You lose all of it because you just make the system so damn big that nobody does any of the checking. And so it doesn't matter that you get the payments back and the quote-unquote granular ownership, because it has nothing to do with Bitcoin. Bitcoin is no longer the arbiter. It'll just be dictated by whatever five nodes run the system, which will be Google, Amazon, Visa, the government, and, you know, Facebook. And I think the people who thought that we were just going to have infinite blocks also discounted just how fast that can happen and how low the cost barrier on that side of things could be to cause such a significant loss in the underlying validation. Like, one of the things that drives, like, bugs the hell out of me, or is, I guess, sad to see, is how few nodes there are on the Bitcoin network when the cost to run a node is still so low. People aren't running nodes. I think the last stat that I looked at was like 16,000. Like, we had over 100,000 at one point during all the block size war stuff, actually. But 16,000 nodes is not many nodes. And if the cost required like 32, maybe 64 gigabytes of RAM to run a node, which is totally reasonable for, you know, a decent consumer hardware, but then, you know, also 1 terabyte of data. That's only 20 megabyte blocks. That's a terabyte every single year. Here's the thing that people don't get about the cost of running a node and actually being a validator for your ownership and your Bitcoin on the network, is that people think that, okay, well, yeah, you can just do it with a decent computer, so anybody can just buy that and run it on their computer, except that it would require you to designate that computer for entirely that purpose. So it's not, you know, can people relatively afford that sort of computer? It's that, can they relatively afford that sort of computer twice so that they don't have to be bogged down with their normal computer use by running a massive Bitcoin node? And understand, 20 megabytes, 100 megabyte blocks are nothing. Nothing in the face of the scaling problem. That's why that was never a solution. It literally comes with all of the exact same trade-offs we're talking about with layer 2 and layer 3, except that it's a systemic trade-off rather than the trade-off of some individual user or business or service provider or nation state or anybody or any system within the network that chooses to make a trade-off. It's a trade-off of the entire system itself from even being able to provide the thing we are trying to achieve. You will never get more decentralization than you can get at the base layer of Bitcoin. There's no way to make it more secure or more decentralized on top of that. That is always our max. So we want that maximum to be as huge as we can possibly make it. Then we can actually make those trade-offs to try to extend that ideal degree of sovereignty to every single corner of this planet, if we can do and innovate in every possible way that we can think of in order to do that. And I think it's possible. I do think it is. I think when you align the incentives and you create an open, permissionless battlefield for achieving these sorts of goals and establishing a strong, highly incentivized market for people to be creative in this way, and you give people a taste of that freedom, and they want to extend it to as much as possible, I think anything is possible. And all I can ever do is think the internet as the perfect example is that the internet enabled Bitcoin to exist. In fact, there was such a long string of things that had to fall in place and discoveries that had to be made before Bitcoin could have existed. Bitcoin couldn't really have done it any earlier. So it's important to remember that Bitcoin is a result of the open, decentralized nature of the internet. They finally solved decentralized money. Now within decentralized money, we have to solve decentralized payments, decentralized scalable sovereign payments. We've kind of done that, but we've failed, and it's highly limited because of the incapacity to create the decentralized sovereign ownership at scale. And I expect that this will be an ongoing and forever process of getting to the next thing, to the next layer, to the next protocol, to the new design. But we will undoubtedly need some soft forks to get there. And this is specifically why I have Activate Covenants in my Twitter profile name, is because I think it's going to be a lot harder to implement. Like, I not that I'm like trying to be like, oh, let's just rush and just pick one. Like, I'm not a developer here, and, you know, there's tons of trade-offs with all of these. This is kind of why I'm a supporter of CTV, because it seems like the simplest, least risky, and has been around and is tested, or has been quote-unquote complete for the longest amount of time proposal for this, with the least externalities of like, well, what else could you actually do with this, which sure limits its functionality, but it also limits its attack vector, which I think is the more pressing concern when we're talking about things like this. But we're about to get ETFs, for better or for worse. And I think when the traditional finance bros get here, they are going to feel like they are the ones in charge. Imagine if the people who owned the major gold ETFs and the central banks of the world that held gold, imagine if gold was having a soft fork that was changing one of its characteristics. Do you think anybody in those institutions would have something to say about it? So it's important to remember that even if there is this perfect scenario of like all of these other things we can add, it might also be a really prudent idea to go back to the one with the smallest profile and the longest Lindy effect, and maybe just getting something on the table or a client with a scheduled day or a flag day, even 2 years out for something like this, purely so that when the traditional finance bros get here, this is already in the plan, that this was already set up to happen. I think that would really, really work in our benefit. But anyway. Really great article. Maybe we'll do a show on that. Really great article. Thank you, Ben, for this one. I sent some zaps your way. I'll have the link in the show notes, so anyone else who wants to toss some sats onto this one will be able to. I'll have Stacker News and Abla.news link for the Noster lovers out there. And do not forget to check out our sponsors, especially if you are trying to make that move with your retirement account. ahead of those ETFs, check out swan.com and their Swan IRA. And then, of course, if you want to be a true Bitcoiner and hold your own keys, you get yourself a cold card with my discount code BITCOINAUDIBLE, all one word. All of that you will find so conveniently right in the description of this show. Thank you guys so much for listening. Do not forget to subscribe and share this with everyone you know who hates Lightning. They will love this one. Share this with all your crypto friends. And I will be here. I am Guy Swan. Until next time, guys, take it easy. There are no solutions. There are only trade-offs. Thomas Sowell.